Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Trainspotting, the 1996 film directed by Danny Boyle, screenplay by John Hodge, based on the novel by Irvin Welsh. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Aran.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Now, before we jump in, we're going to match the explicitness of the movie in our podcast, potentially. So there might be swear words ahead. Be warned. But so we're doing that thing where one of the team members chooses a bunch of movies that the others haven't seen or maybe should see again, and we pick it, and then we go watch it. So, Brian, Trainspotting was one of the films on your list that we picked. Why is Trainspotting one of your favorite films? Why do you want to talk about it?
Well, I wanted to talk about it because I thought it'd be funny to make you watch it.
And here we are. And so it was.
No, it had come up before. I know that Trisha loves this movie, and I know that Michael and Alex, you haven't seen it. So it sort of felt like, okay, I at least have one ally and then two film people who haven't seen a movie that's usually considered one of those must-see filmic kind of movies. So
right.
It was always on my mind of something we could talk about. I had thoughts about doing a video on it at one point. And yeah, we can get into more like my history with the movie, but that was the main reason why I thought it would be a good fit for a movie that brands me, I guess, or represents me. That would be an interesting conversation, to say the least.
For sure. Yeah. And it absolutely is one of those movies that is like has always been on my list of like, I know I need to check this box at some point. So it was like, okay, this is on the list. Let's do it. Let's check this box. It has now been checked. Trisha, it's also one of your favorite movies then?
Yes. This has always been one of my favorite movies since I saw it, which probably would have been in college. So not when it came out. I definitely would have been too young in 1996. But it's so hard to describe why I love this movie. It's really funny is thing number one. At least I found it really funny at the time. Mm-hmm. Partially because it is so irreverent. It is this like crazy sensory experience where it's so out there and in your face. It just like you have to laugh in response to it because like you don't know what else you're supposed to fucking do, basically. Like it hits you over the head from the very first frame with the music and the editing and the direction. Just, I don't know. If you can get on board with it early enough, it takes you on a ride. And I adore it for that reason. And I just really, really respect the filmmaking. It was very influential at the time. And especially if you can tap into sort of like the fun of it and not just how awful it is.
Right.
I don't know. I fell for it hard.
Yeah. Well, yeah. One of the things I wrote down when watching it was like, this feels like an R-rated Edgar Wright movie, which there are
many
Edgar Wright movies, but
wait,
you know, a really R-rated Edgar Wright movie. Like
hard
the
R.
Most extreme. But with the filmmaking style and the wit and humor and callbacks and all of that stuff. It had that kind of momentum that I recognize as being Edgar Wright-ish.
Well, and Danny Boyle-ish.
Right. you can almost track the sort of Trainspotting, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels,
yep.
Snatch, Shaun of the Dead. You know, it's like each one gets a little sort of cleaner and less indie film feeling, but they all have this very stylized kind of hyperkinetic feel to them.
Totally.
Absolutely. There's a slightly surreal nature to the whole thing.
Slightly?
Not, I mean, yeah, well, sometimes very surreal, but even in the scenes that are meant to be not in a drug-induced state, there's a kind of hyper reality to everything, and it puts you in this weird mind state that you don't really feel like you're in reality anymore. You're in this strange in-between, and like you said, Trisha, it really is a ride. Like, I was kind of like breathless watching it. Like, I don't know where I'm going or what's happening, but like, I'm just along for this insane ride and it's going to hit me over the head with like the most shocking thing I've ever seen. And then something funny is going to happen. And then like a poop joke. And like, I was just like, what? Lots of poop. Like, it just, I was just like banged around by this movie. And I was like, really not even sure what was happening to me. So it was, seeing it for the first time is quite a like jarring experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't imagine being in my 30s and watching this for the first time.
Right.
Like, that is the thing, is that there's this youthful irresponsibility,
right,
sort of like, you know, they are living outside of normal society. They're living as though there are no consequences, even though they do run up against incredibly terrible consequences, right? The pursuit of that, you know, sort of unhinged freedom. If you're watching it when you're that age, like, it just taps straight into your vein and channels that. I have no idea what it would be like to watch this now for the first time.
Right. I mean, it also comes from an era that I think that we've kind of 180'd from, maybe, which is the sort of unsanitized indie films of the 90s. You know, so you had like Clerks and Dazed and Confused and Trainspotting. And it was sort of like, it was de rigueur to have a movie be just like, no holds barred. These are not good people. They're doing crazy things. And there's lots of swearing and bad behavior and stuff, but that's just kind of the style of the time. And then movies have gotten a lot more like crisp and clean technically, but also I think subject matter wise since then. And it's not to say there aren't still movies that deal with some of this stuff, but there's not this sort of like, basically almost like with Apocalypse Now, where you're saying like, we're just going to go film people being horrible and put it and edit it and put it on screen kind of feeling. You don't get that quite as much these days. So I think for me, seeing Trainspotting in the late 90s, it felt like, this feels like a current movie. It feels like a normal movie, whereas maybe watching it in 2020 is a little like, wait, this is what movies are?
Well, and Bri, what you just said reminded me that Pulp Fiction came out in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's a lot of like sort of Tarantino-y kind of influence here too. Not that it's violent, but just in sort of the lack of safety in the world itself, where like shit's gonna happen in this world and you can't predict what it is, right? Where the movie purposefully takes these turns that it's constantly leaving you questioning even what you're looking at, and as well as what's happening, in the way that Tarantino movies kind of do, where they don't in any way sort of, establish like a safe playing field for the action to happen on. And so I think there's that has that unhinged sort of feeling to it that you're describing. And then I was remembering too, 1996 was also the year of Fargo. It was also the year of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Right.
And Bound also came out that year.
Romeo plus Juliet.
Romeo plus Juliet was that year as well. Different filmmakers were really exploring with what they could make, not just in terms of like quote unquote bad behavior, but sort of pushing filmmaking technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Danny Boyle's previous film, his first film, was called Shallow Grave, which also has Ewan McGregor and Christopher Eccleston. And I think Carrie Fox is the other lead's name. And basically they hire a lodger and then he overdoses, but with a suitcase of money. So they decide to keep the money, but then they have to bury the body and they all basically go crazy, you know. So it's like, to go from there to Trainspotting to A Lifeless Ordinary, like it's definitely this this very sort of not only hyper stylized but also dealing with this very uncomfortable subject matter in a way that is entertaining, even if it's not fun in the way we would think of as like, what's a fun movie, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's interesting to think about like high school me, because high school me was super into the Pulp Fictions, the Requiem for a Dreams. Like, there's that angst that was in these 90s indie like raw films that it's interesting. I am like more of a fuddy-duddy now, I guess, you know, in my 30s, you know. It's like I'm more kind of like looking down on it a bit, and it's like, oh, these like these guys and all their angst, it's like,
right,
calm down.
At one point, I literally was like, why don't these people get a job? Was a thought. I was like, wow, I just
my
said
God.
That.
You've become a boomer.
You guys should watch Trainspotting too, because it's really like, it's really these 40-year-olds looking back at these 20-year-olds. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to realize that like for you guys, you watched it almost like in the appropriate like mind state of that, like, and it also was just exciting to discover that kind of cinema at that age, you know, when when you're in high school and you're like, oh, whoa, movies can be this too. Like, that's so radical that like, regardless of even the content or like, I'm like over you know, analyzing it now. But like back then, I would have just been thrilled that a movie could even do this stuff. Like, holy crap. Like, this is crazy.
Right. I will say I did not see this for the first time in the correct mind state. I was at Woodstock 99 and it was 105 degrees outside. And the only place with air conditioning was this giant airplane hangar, or I guess standard size airplane hangar, which is a giant room. And they were just showing movies on one of the walls projected. And I just went in there to, it was like 95 degrees in there. So it was somewhat more tolerable. And I just pulled up like a pizza box to put my head on and just like tried to take a nap in the middle of the day because it was so hot. And I think I fell asleep during one 90s indie movie and then woke up during Train Spotting, and there was just like poop was being flung places, and I was like, what is happening? What's going on? And then I was like in and out of sleep as like,
I argue that is exactly the correct mind state to see this in. Yeah, right. What's the problem?
Brian, your life is so different than mine.
He was in an airplane hangar.
And then a friend of mine who was following every piece of information about Star Wars Episode One, he finds out that this actor Ewan McGregor is playing Obi-Wan.
Of course.
So he goes and says, who's this? Oh, the guy from Trainspotting. I have to go watch Trainspotting. And then he's very confused as he's watching Renton and being like, this is Obi-Wan? I don't understand. Yeah. But then he fell in love with Trainspotting and with Ewan McGregor. And then I think at some point then he said, you know, you should rewatch this movie. And then I like watched it and watched it again.
Actually watched it.
Yeah. And so yeah. It's sort of like, it's not one of those movies where I saw it once and was like, this is great. It was more just my love for it developed over maybe a decade of sort of watching it and then appreciating it and then watching it again. And then finally getting to a place where I was like, yeah, this movie sits really well with me.
And I fully admit that probably the bedrock of my love for this movie is just a rebellion. Like at the time, of course, I was raised really conservatively. And in the same way that you like pick music, you know, your parents are going to hate. And you're like, this is my favorite band now. You like get their band t-shirt and wear it around your parents because you know it's going to piss them off. Like, that's kind of why I love this movie. Just because that's the spirit of this movie in general, right? Mm-hmm. Is society wants you to be a certain way and you're just not going to because you don't want to. Because you don't want to. You don't choose to. You know, that's obviously like a juvenile sort of attitude to have. And the characters in this movie, of course, push it to the most extreme place possible, right? They not only just, they're not acting out necessarily in healthy ways that everyone sort of does in adolescence. They're definitely going too far with it. But that just like, spirit of I'm gonna do what I want to do because I'm 18 or whatever, that is fully embodied here.
When it feels kind of like a unique version of that was a product of the times. Also, we kind of talked about this in our Terminator episode, I believe, where sort of like the idea of the every person like existed in a way that it might not today because culture is, there's just so many more cultures all happening. Like, there isn't just the one culture that you can like rebel against. There are all these like mini niche cultures that are all happening at once.
Well, also there's more diversity being represented on screen and stuff. So we don't have the, well, here is the everyman because it's the same person we've seen in the last 10 movies we watched.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. And I think that is what's so interesting to me about seeing this movie and then reflecting back. You know, I didn't see this movie at that time, but around this time was when I was seeing things like Fight Club and definitely having that similar reaction of like, yeah, this so like capitalism and I don't want to have a normal job and just be a normal guy. And it sucks that we didn't have a war to fight in is the problem that I guess Edward Norton has in this movie. But there is just like this like spirit of like, yeah, rebelling against the oppression of like the whatever the hell culture, like
boring
or
90s
something.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that is
suburbs.
Appealing. Right, yeah, that is so appealing.
You're saying that I'm just stuck as a teenager because I love Fight Club and I love Train Spotting, so I just still love the like 90s angst.
I think the things you love, like you maintain that feeling
of course
time. Like
yeah.
I think I would still like, I'm curious to watch Fight Club again because I want to know, is 30 Michaels going to overpower, you know, 17-year-old Michael?
Right.
When I watch it again.
And I think that the theme of this movie, or one of the strong themes about this movie, is that sort of 20-something angst and the sort of existential crisis, you know, Choose Life was actually this, it was basically the English version of Just Say No. It was this sort of 80s anti-drug ad campaign. So then it's satirized in this monologue of, to all these, you know, 40-year-old squares, Choose Life means, oh, you're getting a television and getting a matching, you know, Tyler Durden comes in and says you're matching a striped couch or whatever. Yeah. And they're just sort of so rebellious against this, like, oh, this is what our parents are, and our parents are lame, and everybody is lame. And of course, the irony is their alternative is becoming burnouts and risking their lives and being miserable all the time and all that kind of stuff. And I think that, like, that's why it's sort of fascinating, but also heartbreaking to watch these characters, because it's like, even if we have not been drug addicts in our lives, we all probably have been at that place, probably in our early adulthood, where we were so everything was so idealized, where we were like, I'm not going to live life like this, and I'm not going to do all this lame stuff that everyone else does. But then meanwhile, we're probably doing something very hypocritical, like, not again heroin, but like, just we are saying we're going to do all these things, and we're not actually doing all those things that we say they're going to do. And then what the reason I love the sequel so much is because then it sort of takes that same concept, but it deals with like the 40 something existential crisis of, great, now I have kind of established my life and started a family and got a job. I still don't really know where I'm going. I still don't know what I want to do. And I just think, like, I think those kinds of movies really speak to me, because I think it's something we've all sat with in some way at some point.
Kind of coming off of that, one thing I identified with really early on in the film was the honesty right up front in the opening montage of, like, we're not stupid. Like, we're not doing drugs for, like, in this weird way where, like, the DARE program and, you know, the British version of DARE, which is kind of like, doesn't even tell you why people would ever do drugs. It's just kind of like, just say no to this thing that is only bad. And there's, like, no reason you would ever want to do it, kids. And I kind of liked the honesty up front of, like, we're not idiots. Like, we're doing this because it's amazing. It feels amazing. And there's also that montage of people telling him he's poisoning his body while, like, drinking and smoking. Mm-hmm. And just the kind of the really nice kind of, like, weird, just revealing that, like, yeah, there are, like, socially sanctioned drugs and then non-socially sanctioned drugs. Obviously, heroin is, like, undeniably life-destroying. So, like, there's definitely is a difference between alcohol, cigarettes, and heroin. Sure. But, and that's something that I kind of resonated with, of just, like, also the weird arbitrariness of drug laws, of, you know, the fact that there are drugs out there that are maybe less harmful than alcohol, but they're classified as Schedule One. You know, like, that helped me buy into the movie right up front in an interesting way, which is, like, we're not going to, like, talk down to you about drug use. It's about, like, the reality of this experience. And
yeah,
and so that was resonant, and would have been resonant especially back when I was, you know, rebelling.
Yeah, he has that line where he says, like, I took some of these drugs from my mom, her legally sanctioned
Valium,
drugs.
Exactly. Yeah, the pharma drugs.
Editing is one of the most important and easily one of my favorite parts of the filmmaking process. The first time you put two shots back to back and realize that suddenly you've created meaning is a truly thrilling moment. But one of the challenges of editing is that, like anything else, it takes a lot of practice. So what do you do if you don't have a camera to go out and shoot something? Well, what I would often do when I was younger is just take footage from elsewhere and start to play with it until I created something that I liked. It's a simple idea, but it can be hard to know where to start, which is why I want to recommend the Skillshare class, Filmmaking from Home, Turn Found Footage into a Compelling Video, by filmmaker Penny Lane. The class is all about transforming existing content into something new, and I can say from experience that this is a great and inexpensive way to hone your editing skills. The better you are at creating something from nothing, the better you'll be later at turning something into something great. This is just one of the thousands of classes on filmmaking, design, and writing that you can find on Skillshare. And if you use our link, skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay, you get 2 free months of premium membership. So start practicing your editing skills today at skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
I think the thing for me that I really like about this movie is that some of these other films that we've mentioned, something like Fight Club, or even going back to something like Network, is that those movies are more about like broad sort of like social or sociopolitical facts or structures. So I think both of those films, Fight Club and Network, are about consumerism. And like, it's making a much larger commentary. So if you think about how a movie like Fight Club gets pushed and pushed until it really, it's not chaos necessarily purely within the lives or, you know, even within the bodies of somebody like Tyler Durden or the narrator. It's more about like what society tells them they have to be. It's sort of much bigger. Whereas I think movies like this are about self-destructive impulses, like within one's own body. And that exists within the context of pressures from society. But I don't necessarily consider this movie to be like anti-consumerism or anti any sort of larger social structure. It's just sort of a journey into one's self and the like self-destructive wrestling these four particular characters are doing. So the Choose Life monologue is setting up a dichotomy, but at the same time, what you were saying, Alex, it's diving into what is that dark seed or that dark core of, especially in a particular time in your life, that makes you want to like probe into consciousness, self-destruction. Like it kind of aims more at that to me rather than, yeah, pushing against something like political.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that one thing I really appreciate about the character design of the five main characters of this movie is that they do sort of represent this spectrum of mm-hmm. of life, you know, for these characters, for this world, I should say, where, as you were saying, Alex, the two characters who say like, oh, I would never put something like that in my body, are Tommy and Begbie, who are arguably like the cleanest and worst of them, like the one who is sort of the most maybe on paper good and the one who is just the most violent and vile kind of person. And of course, Tommy has this very tragic arc, which we can talk about. But then in the middle, you have Spud, who is, you know, an addict, but is very naive and sort of pure and just sort of feels lost. And then you have on the other sort of more towards Begbie end, you have Sick Boy, who is more of a kind of bad person, you know, and like Mark says, he only stole the money because Sick Boy, he thought of it first before Sick Boy did anyway. Mm-hmm. And then you have Mark in the middle where he is sort of, he's not good and he's not bad, but he is sort of like in the middle of this sea of characters. And you see the negative influence the characters have on him, but then you also see the negative influence that he has on someone like Tommy by enabling him, you know? And I just think that like, I really appreciate that such a broad character design, even for these characters who are basically this like single unit, if that makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's also contributes to the feeling of the like friend group thing mm-hmm. where when you're designing like a team or a group of friends, not a team in the way that we talked about in our Jaws video, like a team that has a goal. This team has no goal.
They have like one goal near the end.
Right.
They like, they barely do. Yeah.
Sure. But when you're designing like more of the character web that we're talking about and that we mentioned in something like Shaun of the Dead, what you really are discussing are the different influences or different takes that people have on sort of like the same theme. And so, as you're saying, Brian, they have distinct personalities, distinct reasons for behaving the way that they do, and yet they're all kind of circling this one central issue. And at the heart of that is Renton, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think I agree. It's just really, really good character design. And it helps you go on that, like, I'm just going along with this group of friends kind of ride, which they, you know, acknowledge in the dialogue. Like, yeah. Begbie's crazy, but he's a mate, so what can you do?
Right.
That was always something that was like, yeah, like hard. It was hard for me to identify with sometimes where it's like, yeah, he's like insane and like doing the worst things possible, but like he's a friend. So
yeah,
I feel like that's an example of a thing that like doesn't translate to like a more mature viewing, like seeing it as, you know, someone in mid 30s. It's like, well, no, that's a terrible reason to keep hanging out with this probable murderer. I don't know.
Right.
I do feel like to that end, also, the casting is really great. Like, that's one of the fun things about going and watching this finally. Like, I knew Ewan McGregor was in it, obviously.
Mm. There's so many actors I recognize.
Kelly MacDonald. Yeah.
The guy from Grey's Anatomy.
Which guy is the guy from Grey's
Anatomy? Tommy. Yeah.
He was a doctor in Grey's Anatomy.
Kevin McHale.
For me, I was like, oh, it's that guy that had like a bit role in Wonder Woman as Spud.
Yeah. Okay. the tank driver from Children of Men is their like drug dealer.
Peter Mullen.
The guy that talks in third person. Yeah. I was immediately terrified when he came on screen because of Children of Men.
Oh, man. Like Ozark, like Peter Mullen is awesome and he's always terrifying.
Yeah, he's so good.
He is the co-lead with Olivia Colman in Tyrannosaur, which was one of my other movies along with Trainspotting 2 of 2010s. And he is just a absolutely terrifying and absolutely heartbreaking performance and character in that movie.
And yeah, and Ewan McGregor, I was watching this and I was like, oh yeah, of course you became a star.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those performances. Yeah.
Dude, skinny Ewan in the nightclub scene, like that's sexy, man. I appreciate that Danny Boyle said that he thought about Malcolm McDowell in A Clockwork Orange or Michael Caine in Alfie as a sort of character who's charming but despicable. We kind of talked about this in our Patreon Scott Pilgrim episode too. They literally have the Clockwork Orange bar in Trainspotting, but a character where it's like, yeah, the things they're doing are terrible and we totally appreciate that they're terrible, but also there is something about them that makes us go, okay, I feel comfortable following you down this dark rabbit hole because of one, how the character is written and presented, but also just who you actually cast in the role to make you go, you're going to watch this person be pretty not cool for a while.
Well, I was thinking about that, and it's the thing about Renton as a character is that he is sort of generally disdainful of other people, but not in any like pointed or really evil sort of way.
Harmful,
like,
yeah.
Exactly. Like, Begbie is so violent and terrible and generally just like wants to fuck shit up with everybody. And Renton is like, has no qualms about stealing Tommy's like sex tape.
Right.
And just kind of says that he's like, I just watched this video that was stolen from one of my best friends. And we, you know, we see that at the end when he takes the money.
The video shop, Tommy, the fucking video shop.
But at the same time, it doesn't really feel mean-spirited.
Yeah.
Like, he's self-involved and he's not really a good person, but he's not actually trying to harm people. It feels like that might be a byproduct of what happens. And I'm not excusing any of that, but I think that's part of what makes him charming.
Yeah. And I think the Tommy example is great because we see the domino effect of how awful that choice is, you know, in the moment.
Exactly.
It's this funny thing like, oh, you stole your friend's thing. Like, okay, that's maybe not morally great, but like, okay, it's kind of silly and like a kiddish thing to do. And then what happens as a result is she leaves Tommy and then he's miserable. And then what happens as a result, he asks Mark for heroin, which as soon as he shows his money, Mark allows him. And what happens as a result, he gets HIV. What happened? And then he fucking dies, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's a very strong choice and a clear choice to take this sort of cleanest and sort of, I don't want to say like angelic or anything like that, but these sort of the cleanest on paper of those characters and actually send them all the way there, and to show how much of that was enabled by his friends who were not looking out for their friend the way they should have been.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mentioning HIV, that was when that came up in the film. It reminded me like, oh my God, yeah, like this community, you know, we always think of the gay community as being affected by HIV in the 80s and 90s, but this drug user community was one of the main, you know, victims of the epidemic. And that was really interesting to remember. And the way it almost made the movie kind of like entered that period at a certain turning point where everybody was asking, like, are you clean? Are you clean? Like,
right.
Just having like that cultural and like societal like context for this film also suddenly made it really interesting to me. I remembered, oh my God, there's this whole other layer to what it meant to use injection drugs in this time, and like the paranoia and the tragedy of Tommy, you know. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that shift in the movie when Tommy dies, there are several shifts here where it gets progressively sort of worse and worse for the characters. You know, first where the baby dies.
That dead baby scene,
it's awful.
I was not prepared for that.
Sorry.
That like kind of fucked me up. That was
sorry.
Like, dead babies that look like dead in that way, like that's just like the darkest shit you can do.
Like,
I kind of resent a movie sometimes when it like shocks me with images like that. So I'm just like, now I have to like have that image in my brain for a while. And like now it's fine. But like definitely for like the period after that scene, I was like, ah, you just did that to me. Fuck you.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that this movie, obviously it's funny because for me, who's seen the movie so many times, I forget about some of the more shocking moments because I remember more of the characters and the themes and the music and things like that. And then of course you think back on the movie or you're rewatching it and you're like, oh, right, there's this. And I do think it's interesting how this sort of shocking quality is introduced. And I think all the gross out stuff is, it's very in your face in a sort of like, we're going to shock you kind of way, but it's also so on theme and showing how terrible these characters' lives are. Is terrible life is characters have, which you know, at first it's like the worst toilet in Scotland where you're like, oh, this is gross, like, but like also it's funny and you think now he's underwater and it's and then you have Spud, you know, waking up in the bed, and of course then it's like it's almost Dumb and Dumber like poop humor at that point, but again it's just it's a direct result of the life choices that he makes, that he is embarrassing himself and just like reaching this like low point. And then of course you go to the baby, and then, you know, the most, I mean, anytime they go back on heroin after quitting or after not doing it, it's just heartbreaking in this movie. Yeah. And I think it's so powerful. But of course the maybe most heartbreaking moment in the whole movie is not the baby, but the moment immediately after the baby where where Sick Boy says, say something, Mark, and Mark says, I'm cooking up, and then the baby's mother just does it
Allison.
Too. Yeah. And then you know, there's a line about how like the only cure for their misery was more misery, basically. And then of course you have Mark's recovery sequence with the whole crazy like horror. It's like almost like a horror movie suddenly, this montage. And I think that whether that stuff works for you or whether it's just too much or whatever, I do appreciate that, as opposed to a lot of movies with like poop jokes or whatever, they're not really there for anything other than to be shocking and stupid, but that every time this movie goes either weird or gross or just dark and upsetting, it's very much as a direct result of the choices that these characters have made.
Right. And that's kind of what I was getting at, Bri, which is that the harm that is caused by Renton and by everybody in this movie is a result of that self-focus, like pursuit of basically just purely selfish desires, as opposed to, which is something that, not that we can get on board with sort of like morally as a society, but is a little bit more understandable than like a supervillain who wants to just like kill a million people, or, you know, like those people are less accessible to us. Because there is psychologically at the heart of all of us a self-interest, we can kind of understand and even like characters that are primarily self-interested. And so that scene that you're talking about is the perfect example of this, where Allison is like, cook us up a shot, Rents. And he said, okay, so I cooked up and she got a shot, but only after me. That went without saying. And so even someone close to him that's in the worst pain imaginable is secondary to his desires. And of course, that ultimately is what, you know, enacts destruction in the friend group and leaves Renton stranded and alone by himself and totally isolated at the end of the movie. Kind of victorious, but isolated at the end of the movie. But still, I think that there's something to our palate. I don't know, our psychological palate, if I can put it that way, that finds that potentially less damning than someone who is setting out to hurt other people for money or for, you know, egotistical reasons, or just because they like hurting other people, which is what Begbie does. Begbie loves hurting other people. Renton doesn't have any particular desire to hurt other people. It's mainly his pursuit of his own self-interest that is sort of what drives this entire plot. And so when he tries to get clean, it's because it's in his best interest to do so at that time. When he falls back into drug addiction, that's also because it's in his self-interest at the time. And so that's why I think that this movie is doing something interesting psychologically, and why we're able to recognize ourselves in somebody like Renton, even if we ultimately would never act the way that he does.
Right. This movie also has a strong midpoint where he goes back on, but then he just has this moment of doubt when he does it. So it's sort of, he has not made this change that he needs to make in his life yet, but it's the first moment where you see him not just do it as an obviously I'm going to do this thing. He goes back and he sits down and he just takes this moment where he's not sure, and then he does it anyway. But I just think I like those sort of quiet midpoints in movies where you see maybe a light start to flicker in someone's mind, but they maybe haven't, you know, we talked about like when Harry met Sally, like just this very quiet dance of these two characters realizing something, but then nothing actually happens. It's just this like little, we see like a little glint in their eye. And I think that's the moment where Mark starts to kind of realize he needs to change. It just takes him a while to do so, you know?
Mm. Yeah. It's an interesting thought I was having while watching this movie is, I was kind of reflecting back on this idea that as a storyteller, you want the audience to empathize with your protagonist, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And I think this film does accomplish that and like brings you along on the journey with him, and you are invested in him despite the things that he's doing or kind of accidentally finds himself in. And I think that's kind of part of it too, is he kind of stumbles into
he's
these
hapless.
Like,
yeah,
right. Yeah. I think that makes them like extra likable. And I think a thing that I always just as a personal thing think about is like when you're telling a story about someone who needs to change, how do you portray their old world where they're doing the thing they shouldn't do in like exactly the right like tone? And I think it comes up for me in movies like this where it's like, you know, doing drugs is bad. And like, if you read a list of all the things that happen in this movie when they are doing drugs, you would be like, yeah, this is absolutely horrible. But my experience when I'm watching it is sort of like, as we get into the second half, when he's living his life in London and is clean and stuff, I'm like, oh, this isn't as fun as when they were like on drug trips and like the filmmaking was like going crazy and like playing.
Except for the London montage. That part's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. that's fun. So yeah, I think that's a question that occasionally comes up for me in certain films. It's like, you obviously want the audience to empathize with the protagonist and, like you guys were saying earlier, understand why they're doing these horrible things, that there is, like you were saying, Alex, like people do drugs because it feels good. Like, like that's, we shouldn't like pretend.
There's a reason the way it's happening. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but just like that balance of like, you know, and even kind of like you were saying, Brian, where like we go back and watch it and sometimes you like forget like, oh, right, this happens and this happens. Like the things that I walk away with remembering from this movie are the like, oh, man, those crazy fun drug trip scenes where the filmmaking's going crazy. Like those are the things I'm going to remember more than the kind of the end state of things. And so that's, and Wolf of Wall Street is another example that always comes to my head.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think it's an interesting and kind of unsolvable idea, but just it's an interesting thing to have in your head as a storyteller. It's like, what responsibilities do you have? Is there any way to navigate it perfectly? The answer is no. And so what choices do you make?
Yeah, I think you're juggling a lot of things when you are dealing with some of that stuff. I mean, I've just never generally believed that showing a character in a movie doing something is suggesting it's a good thing to do. But obviously, just because I don't feel that way doesn't mean other people might feel that way. So I think you have to juggle a few things, one of which is you have to show that the character loves doing this thing, or you have to show how it makes the character feel. So if a character loves doing heroin, you can't just show them being miserable all the time. You have to show them being, you know, better than six, better than any fucking meat injection in the world. like you have to show their response to it. And then you also have to think about your audience enjoying watching the movie. You know, I've talked about the word entertaining before, which we generally think to mean like fun and light. But to me, entertaining just means like, am I compelled watching this? Am I having, not having a good time, but am I having an emotional reaction to this that I want to be having, and not just I'm watching people be miserable and horrible and that kind of thing. You know, with any sort of style or kind of playfulness you do with it, you do run the risk of someone going, hey, that looks fun. But then I also think the structure of a movie is important, where the more fun some of that stuff looks, the more tragic it is when you see their comeuppance, you know? Yeah. And I think that if you saw someone doing something bad and they looked miserable doing it, and the next scene they're dead, it's like, well, yeah, that is logical. But if it's like, look at this crazy fun thing I did, you know, da, da, da. And then you cut to, and then they died, or then this horrible thing happened, or, you know, whatever, then it's like, then that's when it becomes the most affecting. And that's the sort of, as we talked about before, Michael, like the taking your guard down so that you can kick someone in the heart, kind of like, is that your guard is up if you're watching somebody do terrible things and you think they're terrible and you just feel terrible watching it. But if there is sort of this fun, entertaining kind of playfulness with it, then when you see the other side of it, the, okay, great, you had a really nice trip, guess what? Your fucking baby died. Like, that's when I think that you go from 60 to zero in such a heartbreaking way that whether or not, you know, movie X or TV show Y pulls it off well, that's when it can be the most affecting and really get that point through.
I agree. And of course, that goes back to dynamics, which we've talked about many, many times on this podcast, about just having a variety of, like, you're laughing out loud, it's really hilarious and funny, and then suddenly it's very tragic and it almost hits you harder. So there's that. I think too that Renton does, though, go on a journey in this. And I would argue that it does emerge changed from it, right? Like, mm-hmm. There is a structure to this movie. There is a beginning, a middle, and an end. And Renton ends up in a completely different place than he started. He ends up having to do that. And I think this is what's interesting. He ends up in that quote unquote better place because he decides to screw over all of his friends. But at the same time, they are toxic people in his mm-hmm. life. Like, they are the ones that pull him back in every time he's like maybe getting out. And like, he goes to London and he's not happy in London necessarily, but it gets so much worse when Begbie shows up and then Sick Boy shows up and then they have this gag deal that they're going to do. And so he ends up having to cut those ties. And there's this character consistency where he is still very self-interested, but he manages to harness his like character's superpower of being incredibly selfish to get himself out of his situation. So there is a change inside of Renton where he goes from being disempowered and in his self-interest by being chained to heroin as much as he is chained to these people with whom he does heroin. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, he has cut the chains to both because he has like selfishly decided to emerge out of that. I mean, I think it's an interesting conversation about like what a character arc can be.
Right. But I also agree with you, Michael, like you are always running the risk of the sort of glorification angle and that kind of thing. Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But I just always think there's a difference between like having something be fun to watch versus an artist saying, this is something that you should go want to do. But how do you juggle that?
I feel like for me, the interesting thing with films like this, and this is where kind of Wolf of Wall Street falls into the same category and mm-hmm. some other films where it's like, and it's maybe just kind of my outsider perspective as a gay man of just really having trouble like being along for the ride or like feeling a part of the team or like feeling like one of the guys in these movies, because I feel like a lot of the fun and a lot of like the kind of what I'm even hearing from you guys talking about, like, oh, Sick Boy and like, yeah, that character, like, yeah, I love that guy. It's like I like Tommy because like I could kind of identify with him and I've watched his like tragic downfall, but like like, I just kind of am like, for me, there's no part of me that's like relishing the, like, I don't know, like straight guy fuck up group like dynamics. Like, right. Like, I'm not charmed by it really. And I'm not like, so it's interesting just like how I feel like, yeah, these movies play for a lot of people. And like, yeah, the movie like reveals how ultimately this lifestyle ends in a horrible place. But like, it was so much fun to watch the whole time because like, you know, the antics of these guys and like all the like crazy stuff they did.
There's a lot of antics.
And I'm just like, not even, I think it's an interesting phenomenon for me of like, I wasn't really with them during those antics. And I don't, that says more about me maybe of just like being too stuck up or something. But it's just interesting how I'll hear people talk wistfully about a film where it is this kind of anti-hero story, usually about a group of like straight white guys. And I'll just be kind of like, yeah, like I watched them do all that stuff, but I wasn't like, yeah, you know, right. I didn't have the thrill that I hear other people having going on that ride. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think it has to do with being stuck up or anything. I think it's a sort of style thing because I was just thinking about this with Mad Men. Speaking of straight white guys, like Mad Men was a show where you show a lot of people who are basically bad people. And I personally just didn't enjoy their antics or what they were doing as much as other people, you know? And I think it's just, at some point it just becomes a style choice and a personal preference thing of if we are going to show anti-heroes and we are going to show them do bad things or upsetting things or anything like that. Well, you may like watching it, you may not. You know, and there's no sort of right answer for that. But it's usually a lot more interesting than saying, like, let's have a character that everyone definitely loves, because that tends to not be a great character, or not tends to not be a great character, but there's a reason characters have flaws, you know.
I just want to enter into this a movie that I keep coming back to, and that I was thinking about when watching the movie, was Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm. As an example of a character who starts off super flawed, but at no point am I like, I'm having the movie is fun and funny the whole time. And partially, I think, because it's a comedy. And as we've talked about before, like having assholes in comedy is needed.
You need it. Yeah.
Right. But like, I feel like there isn't a point in Groundhog Day where I'm like, ah, I wish he was still being an asshole, because it was more fun to watch it when he was being an asshole. Like I feel like maybe it's the inclusion of other characters and other perspectives that are, you know, that have a kind of a moral grounding place where other people can see that we're allowed to identify, like, Phil is an asshole and there's something good in him, but like, we're seeing how his being a jerk is affecting other people in a just clearly negative way. And I think sometimes that's like missing for me, or like, again, Wolf of Wall Street is the thing to pick on, I guess. But like, I feel like you can kind of name people that do that, or have a shot or two of someone that like is an outsider that sees what they're doing and is like, this is clearly awful. But sometimes it just feels like the filmmaker's like, see, we checked the box. Look, we said it's awful. And now back to doing horrible antic things. But I think you're completely right, Brian, where like I think it is completely subjective. It's what you're bringing into it and what you're reading into it. And so I think it's impossible to account for everyone and navigate it perfectly. And if you go too far, then you're potentially robbing people of an experience that is valuable. And so that's, again, why I think it's not really a solvable thing. Mm-hmm. And that's almost why I'm so fascinated by it, is that it's this thing that clearly has an effect, but maybe can't be measured.
To chime in on this thing, I think that for me, I'm way more willing to give it a pass when looking into the human psychology of what makes people assholes is like part of the text. Mm. And I think that that's like, I actually really like Wolf of Wall Street for that reason. And I think that movies that are genuinely operating on a level of critique, which I think Fight Club also is, are the ones that are committed to doing a really serious interior look at the life of the character and why it is that they're behaving the way that they are. The movies I'm less willing to give a pass to are the ones that are glorying in the actions without questioning the motives and the psychology of behind why.
Definitely.
And,
yeah.
And so I think that that's part of the reason I'm able to really enjoy Trainspotting, because for me, that's what the whole movie is about. It's about the psychology of why I'm able to have fun with the antics, because the movie also does the serious look at the psychology of why. And, you know, yeah, exactly. It's about self-destruction, self-involvement, all the things I've already said.
Mm-hmm. Well, and despite problems that I had, I do feel like the very last moment of the film was very affecting for me. So when the film starts and there is that voiceover monologue about mm-hmm. like consumerism, I was a little bit doing that like eye-rolly thing of like, okay, yeah, 90s. All right, this is all right. We're doing that. That's fine. Mm. And then the antics and all the things happen and you go on this journey. And then by the time it ended, I really was like rooting for Renton and like, okay, thank God you took those idiots' money. Thank yeah. God you're leaving them behind. Right. And then he's like, and now I'm going to be just like you. And then he starts listing all those things again.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I really did feel the like, oh, okay, there is like, commentary being made here now. Like, this is the thing that I was rooting for. How do I feel about that? And so, like, again, I cannot argue that it is not effective, to be clear.
Right.
That goes straight into what I wanted to talk about next, which is just a sort of a look at the opening sequence here. And I rewatched it, I don't know, maybe two or three times this week in preparation to talk about it. And I was just so impressed on rewatching it at the filmmaking and the way that it's cut together.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done a dive into voiceover here. It was such a smart decision on the part of the writers. This voiceover, that monologue, the Choose Life monologue, was originally in the middle of the movie. And then they moved it to the opening because they couldn't figure out how to like start it off. And I think it's so critical into putting the audience right into the action, the lifestyle, like the characters' mindsets, and of course the language of it, which did you guys have to watch it with subtitles on?
I absolutely watched it with subtitles. Good advice.
I was thinking, like, I think if they were speaking Spanish, I would understand more than what they're actually speaking now.
I really respect both the writing of that monologue as well as the editing of that entire sequence.
Yeah, the editing was amazing.
It's the sequence is like actually intercut between three things. So you have the soccer match that's intercut with the scene of them being chased down the street. And then you have the scene with Sick Boy and Allison, like, and Spud's actually also there. Mother Superior's there, and they're just like getting high in the drug house, and Renton is like, you know, in the other room of that apartment or whatever. So those three scenes are intercut throughout that entire thing in just the most really clever way. It's just, I love it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
For anyone who is not interested in watching Trainspotting 2, present company included, I definitely watch the Choose Life monologue from that, because this character Veronica asks him what Choose Life is, and he starts explaining it, and as he's explaining it, he finds himself going into monologue mode, and then it's intercutting, you know, and he's like, it's like, choose Twitter and hope, like, choose posting the social media and hoping someone cares, and choose grabbing the latest piece of tech and all this kind of stuff. And sorry if this is sitting too close to home for anybody, but but then as it goes, and it's intercutting that with different sort of takes on just modernity, basically. But then as it goes through, then you realize Mark's starting to talk more about himself, and he had gone back and seen Diane, Kelly MacDonald, who is a lawyer now and is sort of, you know, is much more successful, and sort of looks down on him a little bit, and it's intercutting him saying, like, choose disappointment, choosing losing the ones you love, that kind of thing. And it's him watching up through the window as he's watching her, like, do her job, and she doesn't know he's watching and things like that. So it's really clever in the way that it's like, we're going to revamp this monologue for modern day, but also there's a lot deeper stuff going on here than just like, we're going to list a bunch of things that people are doing, you know, because then it starts to become about himself and about the character and what he is dealing with at this time. And you can see, and Ewan McGregor's performance is amazing, because he goes from just being like this very idealist, like, yeah, here's all my philosophies about life. And by the end, you can see that he is shaken because of how much he is affected by the things he just said to himself, basically. Also the music, you know, like, you start the movie with Iggy Pop's Lust for Life, and then you have which of course, like, that's what makes part of what makes that opening sequence so iconic, is that music. And the sequel also does this really cool thing where Mark goes back to his apartment and he puts the record on and it hits the first note and he stops it, and then he just doesn't want, so that you don't actually hear the song until a certain point in the movie where you sort of feel like the character has earned it. But then I also love Lou Reed's Perfect Day, which is this song about, like,
yes,
we drank sangria in the park and we went and saw a movie. It's playing while Mark is being taken to the hospital and in, like, in rug view, rug cam.
Yep.
I love this sequence.
And then, of course, you get into sort of like the 90s techno and everything. But it really, I've talked before about the mood of a movie and how affecting it is. And I think I also rewatched the sequel, if it's not clear. And it just strikes me how much a movie like both the Trainspottings, or we've talked about Drive, or David Lynch movies, or Blade Runner, or Seven, like, the music and the mood that, like, the tone that the movie is creating, for me, can be one of the most affecting things about it. Granted, it's usually helpful when it is a take on the theme and a take on what the movie is trying to do, and not just the movie being stylized. But there is this, as you've talked about before, Alex, this sort of feeling of, like, what is my experience while sitting here watching this movie. And I think that for me, music a lot of times can have a big part. It can be like, play a big part in that.
It is a little bit tricky though, because as a screenwriter, you often do not get to choose your music ever.
Like, of course.
And so I'm actually weirdly in that position right now in something that I'm writing, where I'm writing something that's set in the 70s. And like the music is like, would be such a huge part of the film going experience in terms of putting the audience into the world, which you absolutely have to do. And which I think this opening sequence does so masterfully, as well as the music choices throughout, right? Like when we've talked about world building before, a lot of that is the texture of the world, and that's conveyed sonically as well as visually. And so, but as a screenwriter, you often / never get to pick what like songs end up in your movie. And so, you know, somebody like Danny Boyle here, who made this movie for $1.5 million, $1.5 million.
Wow. What?
How much this movie cost. Yeah. It's nuts. And yeah, 7 weeks of shooting. Wow. That was it.
That must have been delirious. That's unbelievable.
Truly. So, and it contributes to the raw feeling that we were talking about earlier. Yeah. With like indie filmmaking in the 90s always kind of feels like grungy like this, because lack of budget and time and experience from a lot of these directors. I haven't read the opening sequence on the page. I would doubt very much that a lot of that kinetic energy comes through that you get from watching it in the screenwriting. However, right. I do think there's a lesson if you're writing a screenplay now, and maybe this is just my lesson if we're getting to that part. I do think there's a lesson to be learned from trying to convey on the page as clearly as you can the texture of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So like probably in 1995, when this was being written, you wouldn't have been able to choose your soundtrack as a screenwriter. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea if John Hodge, how closely he was working with Danny Boyle. But now I do think there's room in modern screenwriting to use all the tools at your disposal to try to convey. So like the solution I'm going with in my screenplay, and you could take this for what it is, that's set in the 70s, is writing the names of well-known songs that I think have the spirit on the page. And so I'll like in my actual screenwriting, I'll do something like, it's a little bit something like this Marvin Gaye song, and just write, you know, it's like, a song is playing, it's probably this.
Mm-hmm.
And writing the name of it on the page, you might not get it, you won't get it probably, but trying to put your reader at least into the headspace, because that's your job as a screenwriter, is to try to get the energy across. And yeah, I mean, and then of course, going back to just how to open a movie, this is a masterclass. And you can't always move a monologue from the middle of your film to the opening, but.
Yeah, a funny example of that is The Social Network, where Aaron Sorkin had written during Mark leaving from being broken up with to back to his dorm. I think he'd written Elvis Costello's Allison, I think was the song.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I've literally been trying to Google to verify right. as we've been talking.
And I think it's like on the Blu-ray, you can actually watch the side by side where they cut it to that. And it just felt like he was sluggishly like moving through the space because this like kind of kinetic song was playing. And then Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross write this 12-note somber piano thing with like haunting drones in the background that they never wrote for that scene even. They just, it was some of the music they had written. And then when probably Ren Kleiss like actually put it there in editing to play with it, then it was suddenly like, now it felt like Mark was like speeding through the campus because it was over this very somber. But I also think that that music sets the tone for the movie after this 10-minute long sequence in a loud bar and all that kind of stuff, that now we're in like somber music land. And Sorkin didn't plan that, you know, he had a very different song choice in mind, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I agree with you, Tricia, that like communicating as much of what your intention is on the page is important in any aspect of screenwriting.
Yeah
And it's also I think why Sorkin needs a Fincher,
right?
Yeah. Hello, Beyond the Screenplay listeners. The four of us, and especially our producer, Vince, love hearing your thoughts and comments about the show. And a great way to do that is to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. A listener by the name of Enemy Friends wrote...
It's cute. I like it.
That's what I think of you guys as.
The name Enemy Friends makes me very unsettled. I don't know if I can trust this person.
Anyway, Enemy Friends wrote, "As an aspiring screenwriter and director, this podcast has become invaluable for me. I'm always looking forward to the next episode, and the discussions always open up a new way of thinking about a movie for me, even more than their videos." Thank you, Enemy Friends. And I know for myself, as a fellow screenwriter, it can be one of the most difficult and rewarding challenges you can ever face, tackling a feature screenplay. So if our podcast helps in any way on your journey, that makes me super happy.
So proud and honored. Thank you.
I just feel like that's a lot of pressure.
So thank you, Enemy Friends, for your review. And please let us know what you think of the show by leaving us your review on Apple Podcasts or hit us up directly on Twitter. We love hearing from you guys. And with that, let's go back to the show.
Why don't we officially go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Trainspotting? Alex, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I was mentioning earlier before we started recording that I feel like this movie, watching it, I feel like a sister to Requiem for a Dream, kind of almost like the more fun Requiem for a Dream.
I would say definitely the more fun.
a lot more fun. Yeah, Requiem for a Dream is just like completely devastating from top to bottom. But one other aspect of it, besides the obvious, like, you know, drug use parallels, is the use of like visual metaphor to get across altered state of consciousness. And one sequence that really stuck out to me in Trainspotting that felt like it could have been in Requiem was the overdose scene, where you have that visual of him like sinking into the carpet. And it actually reminded me of even like Get Out, like the sunken place.
Like
representing something with this visual metaphor. And it was just so effective in that sequence. And there were other parts of the film that did similar visual metaphors where it's not, this is not literally maybe what you're experiencing on the drug trip.
Not but literally in a toilet.
exactly. Right. But there's something deeper communicated with that visual metaphor. So yeah, I think I really appreciated Danny Boyle's choices in creating a headspace, representing a state of consciousness with these really interesting visual metaphors. And it's also why I love Requiem for a Dream. And what struck me about that movie when I did see that at the age I was supposed to or whatever, you know, in high school, I was so blown away by it because I had never seen a film that just, you know, it wasn't literal, but it was communicating the like deeper emotion, energy, like thing of what it meant to be high or what it meant to be spiraling into the despair. You know, it showed it to me with metaphor. So kudos to Danny Boyle.
Definitely.
Yeah. Cool. Trisha?
Like from a process point of view, one thing that I think I'm going to take away from this is this idea of like, I don't know, I feel like I might have said this on the podcast before, but like let the characters talk and you don't have to use it as a voiceover, but it's often really helpful to like write a monologue for your character, even just as a technique to get yourself on the same wavelength as your character, to capture the voice of a character, like sit down and write a monologue. Maybe you'll use parts of it, maybe you won't, but let them tell you. And I'm not trying to sound mystical about the screenwriting process, but just, yeah, I think that some of this stuff comes out of the novel, obviously. And some of the most iconic lines in this come out of the novel. But I also think it's quite obvious that the character work that was done here was a product of letting the characters speak. So, you know, Sick Boy's whole thing is that he's obsessed with Sean Connery. In the novel, he often like has a dialogue with Sean Connery. Like Sick Boy's character is like talking back and forth with his imagined version of Sean Connery in the novel. And that often yields you interesting character insights that you wouldn't be able to get if you're writing about them in the third person. So I think doing the exercise of letting your characters speak to you is immersive and potentially really helpful. And it might get you to that amazing, you know, flash grenade way to open your movie, or it might just yield three-dimensional characters that have distinct voices and points of view. It's a good practice.
For sure. And it's a way for you to talk to yourself also, like you're tapping into your imagination, where it's just like imagination go, and then like later you can look at it with your logical brain and be like, oh, that's interesting, I didn't know that was in there. So
exactly,
it's a good discovery process for sure. Brian?
Well, we talked about it a little, but something that struck me watching the movie this time more than any other time I've watched it, I think, is the the negative influence these characters have on each other. And obviously it's huge part of just why these characters are sort of in this place they're in is because once one goes down, then the others follow. And we talk about supporting characters being there to help push the protagonist to make their positive change, like help them complete their positive change arc. And usually that's because, not always obviously, but usually it's because the protagonist is flawed in some way where the supporting character is not, and the supporting character is showing the protagonist how to correctly take on this theme or this idea mm-hmm. or this problem. Mm-hmm. But Trainspotting is sort of the opposite, which is you surround Mark with these characters who are all bad and all sort of negative influences on each other. You have Mark directly influence one of the worst tragedies in the movie, which is Tommy's downfall. But then at the end of the movie, the reason that you sort of celebrate Mark, or like you said, Michael, root for him, is not because he gets off heroin, because we've seen him do that three times in the movie and it doesn't stick, you know, because he, and I think the London, I love the London montage because it shows this new bright kind of future for Mark. And then it only goes bad when the characters come back into his life, and then everything goes to shit basically. So I think the reason we root for him at the end of the movie is not because he has necessarily cleaned up his act or anything like that. Like, he literally does a drug deal and then screws over his friends, you know, but the reason we root for him is because he is finally removing himself from this circle of his supporting characters, basically. So we are saying, like, he is physically around these people who are doing him a disservice. And then the reason he is sort of complete at the end of the movie is because he actually walks away from them. So I think designing these supporting characters in a way where the most powerful thing you can do is just to leave.
Mm. For sure. It speaks to, again, in the movie's defense, I think it does speak to one of the reasons these cycles happen is because of, like, the social pressure and, yeah, feeling an obligation to the people around you and all those things. But yeah, it is kind of funny and awesome that, yeah, the way he grows is by screwing over people after a drug dealer. Like, that is the completion of a character arc that is, like, legitimately awesome. Yeah, I think for me, the thing I was struck by start to finish was the momentum of the filmmaking.
Yes.
And it's mm-hmm. just it takes you on a ride, and there are movies that I think try to do it where they're just, like, bashing you over the head with it and just, like, constantly, like, we're gonna go fast and show you things constantly and look, it's style, and it can be, like, exhausting and kind of not accomplish that thing. And so I feel like this movie somehow strikes this really nice balance where it never feels like it's just out of control. And it never feels like we're stalled and kind of just waiting for the next thing to happen.
Right.
Like, despite, like, bumps that I was having about just, like, the shock of what I was seeing, at every moment I felt like I was being carried forth along this journey in a way that feels very confident, mm-hmm. That is just super, I respected, like, from start to finish. So, yeah, the editing and the rhythm and the nice balanced momentum of the film, I thought was extremely impressive.
Yes.
And I could see also how it clearly inspired films that came after it that I also loved, which is always one of the reasons to go back and watch these old classics, is to understand, okay, this is where all of this started, and everything else has been an iteration on this idea.
Mm-hmm. Super old classic.
1996.
It is a longer time ago than I would like.
24 years ago.
It's a while now.
Yeah. Cool. Why don't we go around and say what we've been watching recently? Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I rewatched a movie that I love and have seen many times. The 1979 movie Being There, directed by Hal Ashby, who also directed Harold and Maude, famously. And is sort of one of those, as we kind of talked about with Francis Ford Coppola a little bit, like one of those very realist directors where you just feel like you're watching almost like a documentary the way he presents things. But it stars Peter Sellers and Shirley MacLaine. And Peter Sellers is a 50-year-old man who's a gardener, and he has never left this house where it's sort of a mystery how he even ended up there. But, like, this old man lives there, and he's just his gardener. and the old man dies and Peter Sellers has to go out on his own, but he has no experience. So he's basically like a child, basically. He has no experience with the world. Everything he knows from watching TV, and he sort of has no like emotional connection to anything. And then he meets Shirley MacLaine, who is awesome in this movie. And she's part of this political family. So she takes him in. And basically, because he is this blank slate of a character, all the other characters he meets imprint on him. So anything he says, in their mind, he's saying what they think he should be saying, basically. So the midpoint of the movie is he meets the president of the United States, and the president asks him about the economy or something. He says, what do you think about the growth? And then he hears the word growth, so he just thinks about gardening because the only thing he knows. And he says, well, as long as the roots are not severed, there will be there will be growth in the winter or in the spring and summer. And the president says, ah, so what you're saying is that as long as the financial blah, 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 you know, and then Shirley MacLaine sort of falls in love with them and everything. So it's just this like, I just love it. Explores this theme of confirmation bias, where basically everybody just thinks everything they read or see or hear.
They think he's a genius.
Right. They think he's a genius. But also, to me, it's not about him as much as it's about telling of those characters, which is that like, when you just, everything you read, you get this political sort of arguments all the time. Everything you read or see or hear, you just think it is supporting your argument, even if it's saying the complete opposite thing, you know? So it's just always that like, or, you know, four people watch a movie and we all think the movie is saying a different thing or something. But it's sort of like all the people he is around are absurd, but in a way that feels sort of earned by the movie, because they all just want, they want to believe a certain thing. So they just assume that he is completely, saying exactly what they want to hear, basically. And it's just a really fun movie that I love watching.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
It's kind of like Forrest Gump, or at least that's what it always reminds me of. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of sounded like, people projecting onto.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Awesome. Trisha, what have you been watching?
So I saw a movie that came out in 2020.
Wow.
How is that possible?
Well, it's on Amazon. It's on Amazon. It's an Amazon original. It's a very, very interesting movie that I think you guys would really like, called The Vast of Night.
Okay.
It is directed by Andrew Patterson, also written and produced by him, starring Jake Horowitz and Sierra McCormick. It is this 1950s Twilight Zone kind of some Stranger Things vibes to it, but just very stylistically fascinating. It's super low budget, but it's just like breathtakingly confident. It's almost like a podcast that you watch in some ways, where where there are lots of really, really long shots that sort of capture that radio theater kind of feeling to it. And so it's set in this really small town. The main characters are the radio operator in this, or the radio DJ kind of like personality guy in the town, and then there's a young woman who is the switchboard operator, and so there's like radio interference with them, and like the switchboard's fuzzing out, and he's getting interference with the radio station, so they're like kind of working together to try to figure out what's going on. It's like maybe an alien invasion thing. It's very 50s sci-fi, but it's just really stylish and interesting. So this director Andrew Patterson is a mostly commercial director, but definitely like had a vision for this movie, and I really, really enjoyed it. So it's in my top films of 2020 so far. Wow. I would say.
Nice. I'll check it out.
The Vast of Night.
Yeah, looking through this, the cinematography looks gorgeous.
It's great.
Like,
yeah.
Frustratingly so.
That was my feeling exactly.
Awesome. Alex, what have you been watching?
Recently, my husband and I were Netflix scrolling, and one of his favorite films and mine is V for Vendetta. Mm. And so we just started like watching like a scene from it, and then we just kept going. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me how much I love that movie. Like, I just really, really love V for Vendetta. I love the just kind of going all out with the kind of political nature of it. I love the music. I love the performances. I love the kind of like, there's the director, his last name's McTeague. He was like a, he was basically like a second unit director or assistant director to the Wachowskis. Mm-hmm. And then they wrote V for Vendetta and he directed it. And he does a lot of these sequences have this kind of like momentum building montage, where you have all the threads of a story, almost like past, present, future, they come together in this really climactic way, and with the Dario Marinelli music, and just there's just something that's just like pure cinema about V for Vendetta for me that just makes me so happy. And it also felt really resonant and weirdly appropriate for our like conspiracy theory revolutionary time.
Right.
So yeah, anyway, I would recommend revisiting it anytime because it's just a really interesting, enjoyable movie. I like it a lot.
Nice.
Yeah, I feel like it's a movie that definitely benefited from me being 19 or whatever I was when it came out, and just like it, watching it in that moment, it was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
It's like the Bush years. And, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, but what I'm saying is like, for me at least, like I enjoyed it just as much. Like just the pure bombastic filmmaking I just loved. So it's worth revisiting. I think it may hold up for you too.
Awesome. So I have off and on been rewatching a thing that I watched last year. So last year, one of my good friends got married. And so for the bachelor party.
I don't know. It's just not what I was expecting at the right. end. Gosh.
For the bachelor party, we had a very us bachelor party where we played video games all weekend and watched silly videos. But one of the things that he really had just seen, because so he's a big Oakland A's fan and knows like the history of the Oakland A's, the baseball team, for people that might not or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there's a short on Netflix from The Lonely Island that is the unauthorized Bash Brothers experience.
Wow.
And so it's a short that is sending up Beyonce's Lemonade, like it's a visual rap album poem. About the late 80s baseball stars Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire. Mm-hmm. And it's so it was kind of fast. So it's ridiculous, right? Because it's still on the island. But it's tracking the actual kind of like rise and fall of these people. So it's like kind of actually telling a surprisingly compelling story. And like the music is actually really fun and good and emotional at times. So it was kind of just like the surprise thing where we started watching and I was like, I'm going to hate this. This is the dumbest thing ever. And it was actually wonderful. And the highlight is a song called Oakland Nights, because it's the Oakland A's and it's this like, you know, R&B, you know, like Oakland Nights. Yeah. And Sia is one of, there's a ton of guest stars, but Sia is in it. And if you watch the music video is also on YouTube. If you watch it, Sia, who of course never appears on screen, right?
Right.
So Sia comes in, and it's Sterling K. Brown as Sia, and it is just delightful. He is so committed to being Sia, and the song is wonderful. And it's just if you want to go have fun, go watch the Oakland Nights video from the unauthorized Bash Brothers experience by The Lonely Island.
Wow. What a note to end on.
Yeah.
Indeed. So this has been our conversation on Terrain Spotting. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to the patrons for supporting the show and making it possible. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.